The Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee will come to order. DJ, please call the roll.
Chair Leak?
Here.
Vice Chair Payne?
Here.
Ranking Member Casello?
Here.
Representatives Bell?
Here.
Byrd?
Here.
Here.
Clemmons?
Here.
Driscoll has been excused. Jill Lombardo?
Here.
Goff Marcil?
Here.
Jenny? Jenny? Mariano?
Here.
McFarland? McFarland? Smith?
Here.
Snyder?
Here.
Thompson? Here. Trabulsi? Trabulsi? Williamson?
Here.
Zika?
Present.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, DJ. I want to remind everyone to please silence all electronic devices. Members, today we will hear from an expert, Dr. Christopher Nelson from the RAND Corporation on the topic of public health emergency preparedness. We also have two bills for consideration, HB 1353, Personal Protective Equipment by Representative Yarborough, and HM 1521, Disaster Public Assistance by Representative Overdorf. Joining us via WebEx today is Dr. Christopher Nelson with the RAND Corporation. Dr. Nelson is a senior political scientist with more than 25 years of experience as a policy analyst and has worked in a variety of policy areas, including public health, healthcare, workplace safety, education, and others. Previously, Dr. Nelson held positions on the research staff of the Illinois State Legislature, Carnegie Mellon's University's Hines School of Public Policy and Management, and the Western Michigan University Evaluation Center. He holds a PhD and a master's degree in political science from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Nelson is here to speak to us on developing the building blocks of preparedness for public health emergencies. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Nelson, and you are recognized to present.
Thank you. Chairman Leak, Vice Chair Payne, Ranking Member Casello, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present some general principles on public health emergency preparedness. The views I'm going to share today draw upon a variety of peer-reviewed reports and journal articles my RAND colleagues and I have produced since about 2004, when we started working intensively in this area. I have expanded on these points in a written document that is being posted to www.rand.org and that I've shared with committee staff as well. Now, for many people working in the field, the current era of public health preparedness began with the anthrax attacks of October 2001. That, along with concerns about avian influenza and lessons from the 2005 Gulf Coast hurricane season, led to a significant influx of federal funds to strengthen what was, according to the Institute of Medicine, a public health system that remained in disarray after years of underinvestment. Since then, public health preparedness has developed into a distinct field of practice and research, and there have been measurable improvements in readiness, even as federal preparedness funding has ebbed and flowed over time. In the mid-2000s, my colleagues and I had the opportunity to convene a panel of accomplished emergency managers, physicians, public health practitioners, policymakers, and community representatives to develop a consensus definition of public health preparedness that over the years has provided a touch point for discussions about the topic, both here in the U.S. and elsewhere. I'd like to start by stating the definition, which is projected in the screen in the room. After that, I would like to speak briefly to some key issues that thread through that definition. The definition reads as follows: public health emergency preparedness, or we often say PHEP, is the capability of the public health and healthcare systems, communities, and individuals to prevent, protect against, quickly respond to, and recover from health emergencies, particularly those whose scale, timing, or unpredictability threatens to overwhelm routine capabilities. Preparedness involves coordinated and continuous processes of planning and implementation that rely on measuring performance and taking corrective action. As the definition notes, public health emergencies include any event whose scale, timing, or unpredictability threatens to overwhelm routine capabilities. And so hurricanes, large-scale industrial accidents, terrorist attacks, cyber attacks that interrupt healthcare and other critical infrastructure, and even large concentrations of opioid overdoses over a short period of time, as has happened in several cities in the U.S., all of these could be considered public health emergencies. Now, I'd like to briefly comment on five themes that can be derived from this definition, the first of which is on the screen in the room before you. First, given that public health emergencies can come in so many different forms, and I mentioned several of them, it would be difficult and confusing to have separate plans for each type. And so focusing on foundational building blocks of public health emergency preparedness helps ensure flexibility and adaptability in the face of new or unexpected challenges. This, as you may know, is often called the all-hazards approach. And so, for instance, both infectious disease outbreaks and dealing with the health effects of hurricanes require strong coordination and communication among multiple departments, disciplines, and between government and the community. And thus, multi-agency incident management and robust tactical communication are considered core components of public health emergency preparedness. The expert panel that I mentioned a couple of moments ago identified 16 such core components that every community should have. I won't try to cover them all today in detail, but they're included in the written document that I mentioned. Some are very clearly related to health. For instance, surveillance, epidemiology, laboratory capacity, the ability to distribute a medical countermeasure such as vaccines. But others are more general disaster management capabilities such as incident command, communication with the public, maintaining robust supply chains. And others relate to staffing, leadership, measurement, process improvement, and accountability. Now, even the best conceived set of generic building blocks cannot anticipate every possible health emergency. And so in addition to these somewhat generic building blocks, most good public health preparedness plans include annexes for specific threats that require special equipment, treatments, or processes. And so in the 2014 Ebola outbreak, for instance, that outbreak illustrated the importance of precise and exacting personal protective equipment requirements and procedures to maintain the safety of healthcare providers. A key challenge, therefore, is to find the right balance between generic building blocks on the one hand and the specialized capabilities on the other. The second bullet point, which is now on your screen, concerns the definition's emphasis on the term capability, which gets at the difference between having plans, procedures, staff, and stuff in place, and the ability to actually use them in stressful circumstances. For instance, having a centralized coordinating center to help find safe definitions for patients evacuated from a flooding hospital is of limited use if the hospitals don't know of its existence, if they can't contact it when they need it, and if those staffing the center don't have the requisite knowledge and skills. Maintaining these capabilities, as opposed to capacities, therefore, requires ongoing training and exercising in order to keep them fresh. The need for training, moreover, increases where there is high turnover among staff, who often take important skills, institutional memory, and working relationships with them when they leave their jobs. Unfortunately, there's been considerable turnover in the public health workforce during the past decade, which was hit hard by the 2008-2009 recession, and was by and large not replenished in subsequent years. Moving to the third bullet, capabilities involve not just the skills of individuals, but also their ability to work together in teams, and including teams that involve multiple agencies and sectors from both the public and the private sectors. I like to think of this as the ensemble capability. Thus, the ability to coordinate across organizational silos and with the community is key to public health preparedness. For instance, when a hospital must be evacuated, it may involve sending patients to hospitals owned by different providers and transportation resources from multiple ambulance companies, law enforcement agencies provide traffic control, and many other actors. Incident management systems have been developed over the past century to help define common objectives and muster the resources of many organizations in a coordinated manner. But doing so requires practice and trust. And indeed, a common phrase among disaster practitioners is, a disaster is a bad time to be exchanging business cards for the first time. Turning to the fourth bullet, there's a natural tendency for people to focus on the acute events that affect public health, disease outbreaks, storms, earthquakes, fires, the kinds of things that make the newspaper headlines. Yet the severity of public health emergencies is also influenced by prior vulnerabilities, both in systems and populations, many of which develop over long periods of time. For instance, there's evidence that prior health conditions such as obesity, exposure to environmental conditions such as poor air quality, are related to COVID-19 risk. Social isolation is another source of vulnerabilities. It reduces access to material and emotional support from friends, family, and community members. These vulnerabilities, moreover, tend to be concentrated in some communities, unfortunately. And so, for instance, the latest release of the National Health Security Preparedness Index of the University of Colorado, and I provided a cite in my written document, this latest index finds that regions scoring below average in overall public health preparedness have disproportionate numbers of residents with fewer resources to draw upon in an emergency. They tend to be lower income, for instance. And finally, as we noted in our 2007 paper from which the definition comes, public health emergency preparedness is not a steady state. Threats change. Hurricanes may get stronger. Wildfire seasons may grow longer and more intense as they have here in California. Also, vulnerabilities can change over time too. Populations may grow older. Homeless populations may increase as they have here in Los Angeles County. Healthcare access ebbs and flows sometimes with policy changes. And so continuous learning is a key part of preparedness. Now, real events, as tragic as they are, provide valuable opportunities for such learning. And so high quality after action reports, or AARs as they are called, are crucial, not only for identifying failure points and corrective actions, but also for understanding what existing systems work well and therefore need to be maintained and need continued investment and maintenance. And during longer incidents, such as COVID-19, these reports can be done periodically during the response, what some of my colleagues have termed intra-action reports as opposed to after-action reports. And better still is to try to identify and address these issues before something happens. And this is the purpose of exercises and drills. All of these, of course, take resources. Now, I'd like to continue by offering some brief thoughts about potential roles that policymakers can play in supporting effective public health emergency preparedness practice. The first is to keep it on the agenda. There's a natural tendency for people to stop thinking about public health emergencies after the danger has passed. There's a saying, of course, that the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining, but sometimes it can be hard to focus on things like that when times are good. But these ebbs and flows in attention and investment can make it difficult to develop and maintain in a sustained way these capabilities that ensure readiness. And so a key role for policymakers is to keep focus and attention and support over time. Second, foster collaboration among organizational silos and with communities. And so, for instance, policymakers can ask agency heads to speak about interagency coordination and collaboration with the community during oversight processes. They can also signal support for boundary spanners, support multi-agency working groups, joint planning process, and the development and regular testing of strong multi-agency incident management structures. They can also look for opportunities to lower administrative barriers to collaboration among government agencies and to provide resources for meaningful collaboration with communities to better understand risks, planning gaps, and to build trust with communities as well. Next, fostering a culture of learning. Often the most successful and useful exercises are those that test systems to failure. But this is unlikely to happen where people perceive that failures will be punished. And so policymakers should seek to foster an environment where people are not afraid to learn from their mistakes. They can also emphasize the importance of implementing changes and insights generated from exercises and after-action reviews. Indeed, identifying issues and problems in an AAR or an exercise is a Pyrrhic victory if it doesn't lead to improvements that reduce the likelihood that similar problems will occur again in the future. And finally, ensuring adequate resources in order to provide predictable, stable financial support. This helps manage staff turnover, enables regular opportunities for training and exercise, the kinds of things that maintain operational capability at a steady state over time, and allow for the emergence of strong and connected leadership across the state, both in government and the private sector and communities. Much of this, of course, involves state and local health departments, but it also includes actors outside the traditional health sector, such as those who manage power grids, water supplies, and other functions that play an important role in maintaining continuity of health in the population. Indeed, perhaps the biggest and most important role for state policymakers is to keep an eye on the big picture, on how investments in various sectors contribute to an effective and integrated whole of government and whole of society approach to public health emergency preparedness. With that, I conclude my remarks, and I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. And let me start by telling everyone here, I want to encourage you to ask questions, but we will be sending you a link to the report so that you have the written remarks of Dr. Nelson here. And now I'd like to open it up to questions. Any questions for Dr. Nelson? Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nelson, for the presentation. I want to specifically ask about, I know that your overview is about all different kinds of emergencies, but, you know, specific to pandemics and COVID and what we're dealing with now, one of your slides, yeah, the one that's right there, it talks about ensure adequate resources. What role does government normally play in providing those resources as it relates to a pandemic? You know, we were very short at the beginning. It wasn't just Florida. It was all 50 states. You know, we're extremely low on masks, gowns, PPE. What is the role of government in providing that inventory? And at what cost? Do we normally see governments selling that inventory to ensure that our providers have what they need? Or what's your perspective on that, your guidance for us?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Representative Smith, what was that word? What about inventory? I think I missed an important word there.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
You're recognized.
Yes. I just want to follow the protocol. Yeah, it was about
sure.
Masks, gowns, and PPE, that type of inventory specifically, that, of course, I would assume hospital providers need to, you know, have some sort of stockpile, but what is the mm-hmm. government agency's role in providing that to them or selling it to them specifically?
Understood. Selling is the word I think I missed. Yes. I think historically there's been a fairly important government role. As you may know, over the years, the federal government has maintained something called the Strategic National Stockpile. Many states have maintained stockpiles, and of course, many hospitals maintain their own stockpiles. But historically, I think we found that without the role of government, these stockpiles do tend to decrease over time, that the economic incentives, the economic market signals for producing those things have tended to be insufficient. So clearly, the private sector has an important role here, but I think historically it's fair to say that the government has played an important assurance function, that is to say, in making sure that that private sector actors have the incentives, that where they don't have the incentives, that these stockpiles are maintained.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. Members, are there any other questions? Members, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Nelson. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to going through the materials.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, members. Next is a consideration of HM 1521, Disaster Public Assistance, by Representative Overdorf. Representative Overdorf, you are recognized to present your memorial.
Chair Leek, members, Federal Emergency Management Agency's Public Assistance Program provides federal disaster assistance and those grants to state and local governments, as well as certain private nonprofit organizations, for the recovery from declared disasters of various origins. Under the system, the governor must request the President of the United States to issue a presidential disaster declaration. Joint preliminary damage assessments must accompany the governor's request. The assessment is used to estimate the cost of assistance balanced against the population, yielding the per capita impact cost for disaster assistance. Currently, our state's per capita indicator metric is $1.53 per capita, which requires Florida to reach 28 $1.76 billion in damages in order to be eligible for public assistance program. The annual increase since 1986 has been adjusted for inflation and has risen roughly 1.56% per year. FEMA's brand new proposed rule increases the per capita indicator to $1.98. If FEMA's rule is adopted, Florida would need to sustain over $42 billion worth of damages in order to be eligible for the public assistance program. This is an increase of almost 49.5% from the state's current baseline. House Memorial 1521 urges Congress and the White House to request that FEMA amend the proposed rule titled Cost to Assistance Damages in the Disaster Declaration Process for the Public Assistance Program, nice and short, which goes into effect on October 1, 2021. Specifically, the memorial requests a gradual increase in our per capita indicator. Members, that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Overdorf. Members, are there questions on the memorial? Any questions on the memorial? Seeing no questions on the memorial, are there any amendments? Seeing no amendments on the memorial, we'll move to public testimony on the memorial. David Sirdar, representing himself, a proponent.
David Sirdar worked. I'm from Fruitland Park, Florida. I come to many meetings. It's my honor to be in front of you again. I work in emergency response. I was a certified commercial cleaner, water damage, snow plowing, same day. Picked up, you know, worked at night, got a call from the headmaster of Lake Forest Academy, midnight, New Year's or Christmas, a few years, you know, 1990 approximately. Saved every book in the library, had the whole account. That's where the Chicago Bears practiced. They sold the property there. But, you know, you got to have the supplies. This is so important. Preparedness, you have to do it. This bill, I'm so honored to be here. I can't be everywhere, but I believe in this bill. You folks know what you're doing. You're the elected official. I tried to run for office. I won a primary in Illinois. And, you know, this gentleman was from Illinois State. Hey, I got...
Mr. Sirdar, if you could stay on the
certainly, I agree with you. Yep. I am a proponent of it, and I can't believe no citizens are here.
Well, sounds
this
like
is the most important thing that's going on right now.
Sounds like he has your endorsement. Thank you very much, Mr. Sirdar. Public testimony, Nicole Fogarty, St. Lucie County, waves in support. That concludes the public testimony on the memorial. Is there debate on the memorial? Seeing no debate on the memorial, Representative Overdorf, would you like to close on your memorial?
Wave closing, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, please remember to turn on your mics when you vote. DJ, please call the roll on HM 1521 and announce the vote.
Representatives Bell?
Yes.
Byrd?
Yes.
Cosello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Driscoll has been excused. Gilombardo?
Yes.
Goff Marcil?
Yes.
Jenny?
Yes.
Mariano? Yes. McFarland?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Thompson? Yes. Trabulsi?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
Zika? Chair Leak?
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Show the memorial reported favorably.
Thank you, members.
Representative Overdorf. Next up for consideration is HB 1353, Personal Protective Equipment, by Representative Yarborough. Representative Yarborough, you are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this on? Good. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon to you and the committee. I appreciate you adding House Bill 1353 to your agenda. It's good to see everybody today. Just some background, Mr. Chair and committee, on our PPE bill that we have before you. The Florida Division of Emergency Management handles the state's COVID-19 response, as well as other emergencies and disasters. The division assists local governments, hospitals, and nursing homes by supplying PPE. And at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, as many here, if not all of you may recall, the division struggled to acquire appropriate amounts of PPE due to the worldwide shortage at the time. The division is currently required to develop and maintain logistics contracts with suppliers who can supply resources and commodities during an emergency. The best example to use that we all could very easily understand is after a hurricane. We have vendors that are already in place because of contracts that have been procured prior to that that can help with debris removal and cleanup and all of that after a hurricane or weather-related events. So this would be similar to that. The division also has procedures in place for acquiring, managing, and deploying the state's resources during an emergency. So that's background. The bill before you today would require that the division maintain an inventory of PPE in reserve for declared emergencies caused by an infectious or communicable disease, plan for and procure PPE or have sufficient contracts in place for ensuring PPE availability, and make PPE available for purchase by healthcare practitioners or their employers at the cost procured and negotiated by the division, but not exceeding the purchase cost. The bill enables the division to be prepared for future declared emergencies caused by an infectious disease such as COVID. And that, Mr. Chair, and the committee is the bill for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Yarborough. Members, are there any questions on the bill? Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Yarborough. And I apologize for not talking to you about this first. I'm that guy that reads the bills right before committee, so I don't have questions until I read them. So, question. It's a simple bill. I guess the lines of the bill say that personal protective equipment shall be available for purchase by a healthcare practitioner or an employer of a healthcare practitioner at the cost procured or negotiated by the division. So am I correct in my understanding that we would be requiring emergency management to now be selling PPE during a pandemic as opposed to just giving it to hospital providers as I think we did mostly during this pandemic?
Representative Yarborough, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Through the Chair to Representative Smith and the committee, the language that you have cited on page 2 of the bill does say that it shall be available for purchase, but it doesn't. There is not a limitation in here that stipulates that it can't also be provided in other circumstances. I can get a more defined answer to your question. I understand what you mean by that, being sold versus just provided if we have it available. But the intent, I can tell you, is not to restrict it to where it can only be purchased, and especially to other groups that are not healthcare providers. The main thrust of the bill is to try to make it available so that we can serve Floridians first, which is our role and responsibility, obviously, and try to avoid that delay that we had last time that Director Moskowitz and his team faced last year with us, as I know you're familiar with. Let me get you a better answer than what I have today and get back with you.
Representative Yarborough, what I hear you saying is this puts a ceiling on the price but not a floor, is that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, correct. It says that basically we can't make money off of it, that we're going to get it, and it can't be sold at a higher price than what we have obtained it at.
Thank you. Yep. Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the answer, Rep. Yarborough. I think that's first one of my concerns is my read on the language is that we're requiring to sell it to them, but I would certainly look for opportunities to see if we can clarify the language if you'd be willing to allow for that to really just be an option as opposed to a directive, which is how I'm reading it now. Is it correct that in this pandemic, at the beginning specifically, although I think this has been the case throughout, is it correct that the Division of Emergency Management has been working overtime to secure the PPE, and then when they secured it, they simply gave it to healthcare providers and they did not sell it? Is that correct? Is that what actually happened through this pandemic?
Representative Yarborough, if you know, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the Chair, Representative Smith, I don't have a specific answer, but we can ask the division and the director and get back to you with an answer on that.
Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a few more questions, but I want to, of course, let other members ask if that makes sense. So the staff analysis says that the bill has an indeterminate but significant recurring negative fiscal impact on the Division of Emergency Management. I'm thinking that the reason it's significant is probably because we're requiring them to stockpile the PPE and then make it available for purchase and stockpiling the PPE certainly comes with a cost. Do you think we need an appropriation from general revenue? Because my understanding is that, you know, to stockpile PPE on a massive scale is worth the investment, but it is a substantial appropriation I think we should be prepared for and have an estimate for.
Representative Yarbrough, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yours is a good observation, Representative Smith. The bill does not call for a specific appropriation, as you can see, but it also doesn't say that it has to be done more than just this bill establishing the general framework and tasking the division with entering the agreements, similar to how they do for the response to the hurricanes, as I've mentioned. But we have not put it on there for another reason being that this is there's really no benchmark against which to test this or to see what has happened in the past related to the pandemic and the situation that we faced over the last year. So as you pointed out, which is true, there will be a fiscal impact, but we have not said down to the nitty-gritty and to that level of detail that it has to be this or that. We're tasking the division with doing it and procuring it in the manner that they would do it, and if we need to allocate as we move forward resources for it, then we'll certainly do that. But this at least tasks them with beginning to look at it, plan for, as you see, procure it, and begin the process of managing that so we can have a good response in the future if we need it.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Yarbrough. I think it's essential to have the strategic stockpile. However, I wonder what happens if we're fortunate enough not to have another pandemic or public emergency and we have all of the PPE stockpiled somewhere. What happens to that inventory?
Representative Yarbrough, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad your eyes are on it too, Rep. Thompson, because that's really good, and I'll follow up with you about that too. We're trying to get this established so we can move forward here on the front end, but we certainly don't want anything that could be used in other areas to, for lack of a better word, expire or not be of use and just be there and if it's not used or something like that. So let me also circle back with you and see what we can look at for a time frame and a plan on how to address it if so much time has gone by and it's not been needed or used.
Thank you. I would appreciate that because I'm envisioning something dry rotting or,
sure,
you know, it's just there.
Yours is a good question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ranking Member Casella for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Yarbrough. Just a quick question. We're making this PPE available to our healthcare providers. Would that also encompass our first responders, fire departments and such?
You're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And to the ranking member, thank you for the question, Rep. Casello. The bill speaks to the PPE being able to be sold to the healthcare providers. It does not limit others that the PPE can be provided to. And somewhat tied to what Representative Smith asked about, I'm going to get some more clarification there. Happy to work on that as well and make sure that there's no limitation on that, but we don't have any prohibition on that in this bill before you.
Thank you, members. Any other questions? Any other questions before I let Representative Smith take back over? Any other questions? Representative Smith for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll take over if you let me. question about reimbursement, because here's, you know, look, I know that emergency management made substantial investments and spent a lot of money, rightfully so, to get us the PPE when we needed it at the beginning. Also, just for those who might not be aware, we have stockpiled substantial amounts of PPE that we have now. So I like the idea that we're trying to ensure more of a stockpile. The state of Florida has in its possession 20 million masks and 10 million gowns, which is substantial and it's great. My question is, during a state of emergency, we do get reimbursed by the federal government for the purchases of those PPEs. So back to the question of, I guess, as a government agency, selling the PPE to providers, if we're selling it to them at cost, as described in your bill, what do we, as a state, then do with that money? Do we give it back to the feds? Because we're getting reimbursed for it. So it's not like it's coming out of general revenue and then it just disappears and it's a sunk cost for the state. We've been reimbursed. So what would we do with that reimbursement if we turn emergency management into, I guess, a marketplace of sorts?
Representative Yarbrough, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Smith, and you've mentioned good information there, Rep. Smith, and page 5 of the analysis also mentions about the stockpile facility and some of the other things related there, too. In specific answer to your question, that would also be part of that appropriations discussion when we get to the point of procuring these contracts and if there is a need for additional appropriation for that and to the costs that you were talking about. That would be something that we'd have to look at. We know over the past year there's been significant expense for some of these things. You mentioned the reimbursement, and that would be something that we'll have to take into account and look at. And, again, happy to circle back with you and any member of the committee who's interested about that to make sure we're doing it the right way and that we're not just keeping money that we're then, you know, we were getting reimbursed for the cost, and then it's kind of like a double dip. I understand what you're saying. So we need to make sure it's right, and these questions today are going to make it better. I appreciate it.
And Representative Yarbrough, I believe your bill says we can't make a profit off it, so it can't be sold for a profit. So presumably, if we're getting it for free, it would be given for free as well under that provision of the bill. Is that what you understand?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. What I understand from the bill is that we cannot sell it for any higher than we received it. So under your scenario there, if it was something that we received for free, then based on what we have here, then we could only give that away if it was something received.
And if I could also, this, as I understand this legislation, it would require the stockpiling of PPE during non-emergency times. And as I understand it, the only time we get PPE for free from the feds is during emergency times. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Smith, you had another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess getting back to, I think that there's a balance here because our healthcare providers need to have their own contingency plans. The state needs to have a contingency plan, certainly, and that's what your bill is promoting, very honorably so. Are you worried that by, I guess, creating this selling environment for a state agency, that we've somehow disincentivized, for example, hospital providers to have a strong contingency plan that includes their own stockpile? I think, you know, a lot of it's on us, government, but, you know, we also need a responsibility on our providers to have some, not all, some of the PPE stockpiled on their own. If they have a guarantee from the state that they can just buy it at cost from the stockpile that the state has, are you worried that we may be disincentivizing our hospitals, for example, from having their own contingency plan?
Representative Yarbrough, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Smith. That is a very good question, Rep. No, I don't. My short answer would be no. And given that we, through not only the state's purchasing power, but again, having this set up ahead of time, in the event that hospitals, for example, like in what you've used or what you've said, if they were trying to go out and were finding either lack of availability or maybe it's available but it's in the pipe, it hasn't come down the chain yet to them, then my answer is still no. I don't think that would prevent them from still doing their planning and doing what they need to do to handle their needs. But I think we would be providing as a state kind of a one-stop for them to be able to come and, you know that if we've received it, then we can sell it to them, because otherwise they're going to have to go out and buy it, you know, on their own as well. So I appreciate the premise of your question. I don't think it's a disincentivizer to them to still do their planning and do what they need to do, though.
One final question, Representative Smith. You're recognized.
Final question, and then we will get out of here early. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question is, and I think that I've heard it in some variation in some of your answers, would you be willing to amend the bill to make clear that under a state of emergency where we're being reimbursed by the federal government for PPE, which eventually means it's free, but it doesn't mean it's free up front. I mean, sometimes those reimbursements come months and months and months later. So would you be willing to make clear in your bill with an amendment that in the case that we're being reimbursed, that we would not be, that we were not requiring emergency management to sell PPE stockpile to our providers? Because that's really my main concern about your bill, is that we're turning a government agency into an Amazon, when I don't think it's the appropriate role of government to be selling it to providers. Or would you be willing to entertain that amendment?
Representative Yarbrough, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And through the chair, Representative Smith, as we work together our first session, Rep. Smith, on our first committee amendment, I hope you understand I'm always open to good ideas, and many have been mentioned today. So happy to consider it. Let me make sure before I say a hard yes that it's vetted from all angles to make sure that there's not even more that we should consider. But happy to work with you in crafting something, and then if we can work it in and it'll be best, then we can consider that or move forward with it.
Thank you, Representative Yarbrough. Members, are there any other questions on the bill? Seeing no other questions on the bill, are there any amendments on the desk? Seeing no no amendments on the desk, is there public testimony on the bill? There is. David Sirdar, proponent, representing himself.
David Sirdar is a senior citizen that's retired from a medical county. Lake County, Illinois is a medical campus. My son's a male nurse. I have a niece that's a nurse practitioner. Me, I was just in the hospital the other day when somebody hit me.
Mr. Sirdar, if you could.
Well, I agree with this. You got to be prepared. This is our government right here, you folks. This representative, Yarbrough, God bless him for what he's doing. Working hard, getting the bills out for pandemic. I mean, people are dying in my mobile home park. And they are.
Thank you, Mr. Sirdar.
Thank you so much.
So preparation, good. Thank you, Mr. Sirdar. Ida Fernandez, AARP, waves in support. Jeffrey Scott, Florida Medical Association, waves in support. Jack Cordy, Florida Nurses Association, waves in support. Stephen Wynn, Florida Osteopathic Medical Association, waves in support. Seeing no other public testimony, members, is there any debate on the bill? Representative Goff Marcel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Yarbrough. I am up on your bill. I would like you to consider bringing some more professions in, like public safety officers, police officers, teachers, local governments. Just have an open mind and look to maybe bring some more. And I know you said that it didn't prohibit that, but I wasn't really clear with the language that it wouldn't include them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Yarbrough, for answering my questions. Look, my major concern here, which you've alleviated with some of your answers and responses, my major concern is that we're transforming the role of the Florida Division of Emergency Management into a marketplace, into an Amazon, that they will be now required to sell PPE to our hospital providers, to our healthcare providers. I'm concerned about, not having a very clear fiscal look. I think that these investments are obviously worthwhile. I am very happy about the fact that the Florida Division of Emergency Management had the autonomy to be able to purchase the stockpile of PPE that we needed to immediately get out to our providers in a pandemic. That was expensive, but it was worth it. And we needed to make that investment, and I want to make sure that we're able to do that in the future. But because of the fact that some of those PPEs at the beginning, some of the PPE at the beginning of the pandemic was being price gouged, we spent a lot of money on those resources. But it's money that we've been reimbursed by from the federal government. So I'm going to go out on a limb here, because I don't normally do this. I don't normally say I'll vote yes to move it along. But Representative Yarbrough does have a history of even offering amendments that I was a part of helping to write. So I will vote yes under the predicate that I will be able to work with the sponsor to get some clarifying language out there that in the state of emergency where we're being reimbursed, we are not requiring emergency management to become a seller, even if they're not profiting, think the role of government is to be able to provide these resources in a state of emergency at no cost. And so if we can be able to clarify that language in any way, I'm looking forward to working with you, and that's why I'm going to vote up on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any other debate? All right, members, the chair concurs that Representative Smith doesn't usually vote yes on our bills. And I would also like to point out that I don't read the bill precisely the way that you all read the bill. The bill puts a limit on the sale of PPE, meaning that these are the conditions under which it can be sold, which means for no profit, right? And so it ensures that the state is not profiting or becoming the Amazon marketplace that you're talking about. But it doesn't put a floor, and so it doesn't prohibit PPE from being given by the state, and I agree with you, there are most circumstances in which that would be appropriate. And so with that, seeing no more debate, Representative Yarborough, would you like to close on your bill?
I appreciate your close on my bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Ask for your favorable support. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, please remember to turn on your mics when you vote. DJ, please call the roll on House Bill 1353 and announce the vote.
Representatives Bell?
Yes.
Byrd?
Yes.
Cosello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Driscoll has been excused. Gilombardo?
Yes.
Goff Marcil?
Yes.
Jenny?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McFarland?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Tribulsi?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
Zika? Chair Leak?
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Members, show the bill reported favorably.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Committee.
I want to take a moment to talk about our expert's report today, and I want to encourage you each to go back and read the report, because what he talks about are the building blocks on how a state can be prepared for public health emergencies. And essentially what it is, it's a review of those things that are common to all public health emergencies that we know that we can strengthen and that we can put into place today within a look toward what is the special situations of a public health emergency. So I encourage you all to take a look at it. I think it will help us inform what we do in this committee for the remainder of this year and next year. And then get back to me. Let me know what you see in there. Let me know those things that you think we should be looking at that perhaps we haven't looked at. And what I've found along the way here is the state of Florida, like we said at the beginning of the committee, is born of experience. But the state of Florida has the benefit of its experience in the past, and so we are in a much better place than perhaps any of us knew coming into this, and certainly better than most other states. And with that, this concludes our committee agenda for today. Representative Byrd moves we rise. Unless there is an objection upon the motion of Representative Byrd, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.